From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a story as old as the hills. Lovers meet, marry, live, then someone steps in or out. It's the way of the affair, the wandering eye, the cheating heart, the just plain cheating. It hits the famous and the powerful, from Petraeus to Clinton to Tiger Woods, and the regular, everyday marriage. It can and often does blow everything up, and yet we do it. This hour On Point, we're looking at the circumstances and psychology of infidelity. You can join the conversation. Why do we do it when we know what's on the line? Family, marriage, sometimes career. Is it just the way it is and will be? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Seattle, Washington, is Pepper Schwartz, sociologist, sexologist. She's professor of sociology at the University of Washington in Seattle, the national love and relationship expert and ambassador for AARP, where she writes the column The Naked Truth, so there's no age limit there. Author of Prime, Adventures and Advice on Sex, Love, and the Sensual Years, and the Gender of Sexuality. Pepper Schwartz, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Public Radio's KUT in Austin, Texas, David Buss joins us, professor of psychology at the University of Texas, known for his evolutionary psychology research on gender, sexuality, and human relationships, author of The Dangerous Passion and the Evolution of Desire. David, welcome to you as well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be talking to you.
So, Pepper, first to you, I guess we all know why we're here. I mean, the news headlines are full of this. You would think that, well, no, maybe you wouldn't. I mean, after how many thousand years, it doesn't really matter. We're right back in the same place. Are you shocked at these headlines, Pepper, or just, well, that's human nature?
What do you think, Tom? No, it's just a global plot to keep me in business. I'm always shocked at a given individual, and I was certainly shocked that someone who was head of the CIA, especially someone at that kind of position, thought that they could have an affair and that it would ultimately not be found out. Perhaps one night one can get away with, but a continuing affair is unlikely to stay hidden. So I was shocked at the person, not at the behavior. I think we're a mildly non-monogamous animal, and under the right circumstances, we seem to not be able to forego temptation.
But David, maybe we shouldn't be shocked even with this person in this position. I mean, after all, if people can override concerns about all the other dangers that an affair usually presents, maybe it's not that big a leap to override the fact that you're director of the CIA.
Yes, Tom, I think a few factors are in play here in this particular case. One is that women in general are sexually attracted to high-status men, and that's a human universal. The other is that high-status men not only are attracted to younger and physically attractive women, I think that there's actually an evolved psychological mechanism such that high-status men believe that they're entitled to sexual access to other women. That desire for sexual variety is present in all men and a lot of women, but it's especially present in high-status men.
Wow, here come the gender politics right away. Are those assumptions you share, Pepper?
Well, I think let's give a little credit, or lack of credit, if you will, to women. I think that a lot of the appetite of men has happened because they can. And historically, if women wanted sexual freedom, they would likely pay for it with their lives. These days, if you take a look at the statistics, young women are likely to be as non-monogamous as young men. So I don't think their genes have changed, but I do think their opportunities, their privacy, and most important, their independent access to money and career. And the Petraeus thing, he wasn't involved with a babe. He was involved with
this
a good-looking woman.
A young intern. This was an accomplished woman.
Right. This wasn't Monica Lewinsky. This was a woman of accomplishment and status who was probably as much of an agent in her own behalf in this as he was. I think it's a different thing.
You agree, David, in this case?
I totally agree with Pepper on this. The gender gap in infidelity rates has, in fact, been closing. And I think that the factors that Pepper identifies are exactly correct, that as women gain access to their own independent resources, then and enter the workplace and occupy positions of higher status, then they are in a position to act on their desires. As I mentioned, both men and women have desires for people other than their regular partner. In this case, both General Petraeus and Paula Broadwell, they both acted on those desires.
So what does it take, Pepper, for this to go from sexual tension to the affair? What are the circumstances? Is it a matter just of circumstance, just availability, or, you know, enough privacy and time? Is it a matter of individual psychology? How much weight do you put on each of those after some years of looking at these?
Well, I think there's really a lot of different paths to the same ending. In the case of Petraeus, I think we're looking at something that has become a risk for marriage much more commonly, and that's the colleagueship, getting to know each other, getting to like each other's mind, feeling that you're both part of the same system, the same rush of enthusiasm for the things that you care about.
The same six-minute mile running, in this case, we're told.
You got it. You got it.
Even so, athleticism on both sides here.
Yeah, I mean, we want women to have full access to all the positions of power and jobs that men do. But the fact is that when you get into admiring everyday collegial relationships, desire turns to something deeper because, you know, in this case, it wasn't a one-night stand. It was a two-year relationship. Mm. And then love and sex and attraction all fuse into a pretty exotic and powerful mist of desire and attachment. And this is probably a new way in the history of the world, at least in the fact that they also have privacy as well as opportunity as well as a peer relationship. So in this case, I think that's the model. I don't think that's always the model.
The new piece being the peer, I mean, look, over a great period of time, the peer status here?
The peer, the colleague, the sense of, you know, you and I are uber people together. We're both A types. We deserve each other. We commune in all these different levels, including, of course, lust, desire. She's very attractive. He's an attractive man of great stature. The lust for power that women have often gotten through men, now men are looking at, you know, what they think of as their sort of reflected image in a woman and say, you know, this isn't my marriage of 34 years founded on, you know, her domestic capacity. Mm-hmm. I now see another power creature, and it's exciting.
David, what about it? The combination of circumstance or individual psychology or maybe changing gender relations here. I mean, here's Abby writes to us online, you know, the sort of plaintive question, why can't people be happy with little sexual tension between people and other than their spouses and leave it at that? But these two weren't, and many others are not either.
Right. Absolutely. I think that a couple factors need to be introduced into this discussion. Mm. One is that a large number of both men and women feel sexual desires for people other than their regular partner.
Sure.
And it's a very, very common thing. Some stats put it at 74% of men and 72% of women in that ballpark. But a lot of people feel desires for other people. The issue is whether they act on those desires. And one interesting factor that we should introduce here is that some of my research has shown that one variable, a personality characteristic, narcissism, does predict whether people act on their desires. So in questions where you ask people, would you have an affair if you knew that you would never get caught and it would never be found out, vast majority of people say yes, they would. And so it is, they are deterred by both fear of reputational damage, fear of destroying their marriage and their regular long-term relationship. But that's precisely why infidelity is cloaked in great secrecy. In fact, it's cloaked in greater secrecy than just about anything else. The few things that are cloaked in even greater secrecy are things like murder or incest. But infidelity is way up there.
Pepper, what about narcissism? Amity Schles writes in the Chicago Tribune in the last, I guess it's today, saying, you know, this is about narcissism, and it's not the first time. Look at, I mean, this was a biographer, after all. Look at John Edwards. It was a videographer. I mean, Amity even brings in Jack Welch and Susie Wetlaufer, who was a business editor, and saying these women aren't arm candy. They are mirrors or cameras, i.e. a particular appeal to the narcissist male. What do you say to that, Pepper?
I agree with it, but I don't think it's just the male. I think the more, let's call it self-love, narcissism seems so clinical, the more you think of yourself, the more confident you are, the more you think you deserve, the more you've got, had a history of accomplishing and getting what you want, why would you stop in this category when you haven't in any other? So it's no surprise that people like Clinton or Petraeus or for that matter, Broadwell, think that that this is something they deserve and they can handle and they want and therefore should have. I think that we seem to be able to split our moral judgments and our behavior in very tidy, wrapped-up packages that never open up to one another. If you look at the research, 85% of people, maybe higher, don't believe in non-monogamy, but the statistics of what they do are much different.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the way of the affair, the circumstances and psychology of infidelity. It's as old as the hills and in the news right now. Pepper Schwartz joins us from Seattle, author of Prime and The Gender of Sexuality and Love Between Equals. David Buss is with us from Austin, Texas, professor of psychology, University of Texas, author of The Dangerous Passion and The Evolution of Desire, and with Cindy Messon of Why Women Have Sex. Back in January, an interview with Comedy Central's The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, the biographer Paula Broadwell spoke about her frequent running interviews in Afghanistan with General David Petraeus.
When I was in Kabul, we would do a lot of interviews on runs. For him, I think it was a good distraction from the war, you know, and you know, of course, he's a bit concerned, as someone in his position would be, about legacy. And he also, you know, came at it from a mentoring point of view and wanted to help me with this project.
Oh, boy, a good distraction, mentoring, legacy. We'll look at that. And then Jon Stewart wanted to know, well, you know, just how awesome was the general?
People in these books, they always think, I'll give you access. And it never, but in this. I mean, the most controversial thing is, I would say the real controversy here is he awesome or incredibly awesome? It's a nice portrait.
I have a detail to share with you.
All right.
He can turn water into bottled water.
What?
Yeah, and maybe more than that. Pepper, you're listening there. You know, there's the biographer. You know, working on the biography, a good distraction. And he was worried about his legacy. Came at it from a mentoring point of view. And then, boom, the legacy in trouble and mentoring. People will laugh now, Pepper.
They will. And I think it's so interesting that she can lie so well. I mean, I think that's a thing about it. People feel confident and they spin a story. And even though they've seen others blow up, they think their story's better. And you think, here's a guy who spent an entire, and I'm sure, extremely disciplined life building up a legacy that he now has, as he said, shown bad judgment. But it's not judgment that happens. The kind of elixir when two people are strongly attracted to each other. Mm-hmm. And perhaps at this time in his life, he thought, you know, I've been a good guy.
Yeah.
Is this my time? You know,
I
don't want to give this up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I have. And when I've talked to people who are in the full throes of a passionate love affair, they cannot see the consequences of that act. They want to feed themselves their own justifications and their own control of the consequences. And oddly enough, as smart as they are, when it all blows up, they're kind of stunned.
Do they really not see it? Or in the full, you know, magic of the elixir, whatever that is, they don't care. They want this now and that's that.
Think of yourself in a highly adrenalized state. You know, normally we think of that as flight or fight.
Mm-hmm.
But think of it in a highly adrenalized state of not just sexual passion, but emotional passion, of connection. You now have created this little bubble you're in about how extraordinary you are. It is very hard. And I'm not saying guilt isn't there. Mm-hmm. For all I know, Petraeus has had a good marriage. But it isn't this thing. And this thing is wiping away the competition.
David Buss, what about it? Here's the passion. On the other side, the risks, the downside. In the throes of this, how are people thinking or not thinking or making rationales for themselves?
Yes. I think one of the interesting things about infidelity is that the benefits or rewards or pleasurable aspects of it come immediately, and the costs, the downsides, the reputational damage, the destruction on the marriage, those come at a much later time, and they're uncertain. So the benefits are immediate and certain. The costs and risks are uncertain because, in fact, some infidelities do go undiscovered. I think, as Pepper says, the longer the infidelity goes on, of course, the higher the probability that it will get discovered. But there is some evidence that, and this is to amplify on what Pepper said, that when people are in a state of sexual arousal, they do what they call, what psychologists call, discounting the future. They don't think about the future.
Right,
and
right.
Their decision-making does get altered.
Is it different for men and women, Pepper, that discounting? Or are the motivations the same coming into this kind of relation? I'll put that to you as well, David. But Pepper, what do you say?
I think they're more alike than different. I think they may have gone into it for different reasons. I do think men are more likely to go into it with, you know, this is just a profoundly exciting situation and I want it. And I think women are always, or not always, but much more likely to be going to something like this, which, you know, love is just below the surface. The sexual attraction is powerful, but it came from other kinds of attractiveness about the man. And so they may enter from different routes, but the longer this thing goes in, they produce a hormone called oxytocin. They produce dopamine. These are hormones that are designed to create more commitment, more attachment, more love. And they get wrapped in these hormones, and they're off.
How similar, how different the two genders headed down this road, David?
Well, I think that there are certainly some similarities, but there are also profound gender differences. And one of them has to do with the motivation for the affair. For men, the desire for sexual variety, the novelty factor, the sexual motivation per se, is a key driving force motivating majority of men, say 70% of men, into having an affair. In contrast, women who have affairs, as Pepper mentions, do tend to become emotionally attached, do fall in love, and also they tend to be more dissatisfied with their regular marriage. It may seem obvious, well, people who have affairs are more dissatisfied with their marriage, but it turns out that this is much more true of women than men. So if you compare men who have affairs with men who don't have affairs, there's actually no difference in their rates of marital satisfaction. But for women, there's a profound difference. And so if I had to make a prediction, I would predict that Paula Broadwell was much more unhappy with her regular partner, with her regular marriage, whereas that's not necessarily the case with General Petraeus.
Pepper, what do you say, genetic or circumstantial? And I mean over long stretches of time and circumstance.
Well, I'm going to leave the genetic stuff to my colleague here and talk more in the discipline I know. I'm much more a student of culture and society. And I do think there are some, you know, there are some different propensities of women and men for sure. But I think taking it to a slightly different area, I would say that it's not always about how good or bad the relationship is, although that's a factor.
That is the marriage relationship, the one that
marriage,
steps out on.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Yeah. But what I'd also want to add is the blah factor, where the fact is that the sexual attraction and electricity of a long-term marriage is very unlikely to rival that of an affair, or for that matter, a one-night stand. But an affair has all these other deeper things that carry it forward. And I often meet women in long-term relationships who say, yeah, our sex life isn't that big a deal, and here I would be supporting David. You know, it doesn't really affect the whole relationship. We have a great relationship. And I tell them, no. You cannot ignore the sexual health and satisfaction and frequency of your relationship, or you are opening a door you do not want to open for your partner. And that happens with women, too. I think men are more likely to make that sexual issue a bigger issue for the whole relationship. But I think any partner who lets their sexual life go sideways is much more risk for their partner having an affair than not.
We'll look at that. We're talking about The Way of the Affair with Pepper Schwartz and David Buss. Lots of callers here. Katie in Gallatin, Tennessee. Katie, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What do you see out there, Katie?
Hey, Tom. I just want to say, you know, when we're talking about that type of infidelity, sometimes there is the human aspect of with their relationship, I cannot deal with certain things in my relationship, and the opportunity then arises, such as Vice President Edwards, or, you know, when he was running, his wife was terminally ill. It's very difficult for a spouse to watch somebody suffer, and so seeking comfort in another person that they feel comfortable with was what he felt, what he needed, his medicine, so to speak. And so sometimes it's not just the physicality, attraction, or things like that, because I've seen many people deter from that, but it's very difficult when it's also affecting your mental and emotional state.
That's Katie, what have you seen in your own circle, Katie, of friends? I mean, can you put a percentage on, you know, how many might be tempted or have strayed? And if so, why would they go?
Well, I've seen a lot of males and females on both sides, fairly equal, and it seems to be at the core an unhappiness in the relationship is having them be inspired to have a wandering eye. I call it a wandering eye because is there something that can bring me comfort? Is there something that can make me feel a little better? I see it more like a medicine that they're looking for because they haven't found it in their current relationship. And I would say it's about 50-50 from friends to people who have been married 7 years, that seven-year itch. They're not comfortable. There's a lot of problems that have arisen. So there's that. Sometimes I think it just goes beyond the physicality and the chemicals because we can find those wonderful, comfortable things in a spouse or a relationship that goes beyond that, that's deeper than that. But if it's not there, that's when that wandering eye happens.
Katie, thanks for your call. Pepper, what do you think? A medicinal affair, a tonic, or is it just a shot of whiskey?
I think it can be both. I think people do often use sex as a sort of self-soothing thing, but that sex is different than an affair, you know. And if you go into an alternate parallel world, usually it's a much more complex mix of things than just trying to avoid issues in your relationship. There are a lot of people, I think, that don't have a wandering eye. They get aroused and entrapped by their own emotions and needs in ways that actually surprise them. I think the kind of people who have, I think the statistics show that the number of men or women who have lots of partners while they're married is a smaller, much smaller number than people who have a few one-night stands or an affair or two during their marriage. I do think there becomes a risk over time of feeling that life isn't what it should be, and this does become one thought about how you can, without examining all the other things more closely, I agree with your caller there, you know, ramp up your life in a sort of artificial way that gives it some juice, but, you know, as we say, ultimately may cause you much more trouble than you would ever wish for.
Are there any reliable numbers out there, Pepper, on what percentage of people in committed relationships step out?
Boy, I tell you, it varies from study to study. I've seen as low as 11% and as high as 50%. And I think the realities are somewhere towards the higher numbers, but probably not that high.
What's your guess on the numbers, David, or what's your evidence? Have you seen it?
Yes. Well, as Pepper said, they do vary from study to study. And anyone who claims to know the exact percentage is fooling themselves because people don't admit it. So if you go back to the classic Kinsey study, he found 26% of women and 50% of men admitted to having an affair. But it was also that question, posing that question, caused more people to drop out of the study. And that question got people refused to answer that question more than any other question. And so, as I said, it's
talk
cloaked
about
in
don't
great
ask,
secrecy.
Don't tell. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we don't really know. But my inclination is also, you know, somewhere between 30% and 50% of all men and women do have affairs. Larger number desire affairs.
Rama in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Rama, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having this conversation.
Yeah.
So many things I want to get to, but I know the time is short. Oscar Wilde, I believe everyone should always be in love. That's why no one should ever marry. one is one thing. The yes, they hit right on the head. The need for sexual experiences are different partners. Men, I'll speak for myself, we have the need for a variety of sexual experiences and or partners. That the variety of sexual experiences can come with one partner if there's enough love, if there's enough adventure, if there's enough understanding. And sometimes it's enough for us guys just to be able to be honest from our heart. Like Jimmy Carter was honest. Remember him in the Playboy interview?
Lusting in his heart.
Lusting in his heart. Now, because I'm single, so I'm on a dating site. And I saw a woman say, I want a man who only has eyes for me. Well, I'll tell her, go get a puppy dog, okay? Most men will have eyes for other women. And if women would just understand that, Pepper seems to be talking about it. Thank you for bringing this up. If we just have more understanding, women for men and men for women, of what makes us tick, wouldn't it?
But are you discounting the whole idea, Rama, of a committed relationship then? That is monogamous?
I've been in committed relationships, and I think it is possible. What happens is, you know, men, we are predilected towards more variety, okay? So we have to make the conscious choice. We have to go to our higher consciousness and think about what I think it was your male guest said.
David
there.
West,
we have to think about consequences of the future. But we're so in the present that it's hard sometimes for us to think about the future. So primitive things drive us, men more than women, but we still have to make the choice to go for it or not to go for it. And that's where the long-term stuff thing comes in, the love of our family, you know, having a loving relationship, which is important to me. And that's ultimately what I want. But I understand I have the drive and need for variety in different things.
There's the tension right there. We're coming up to a break, Rama. But, I mean, online here, Pepper Skeptic writes, is monogamy normal with a human lifespan of 70-plus years? I think all the evidence is no, says this listener. Rama's kind of on that line. What do you say to that perspective, Pepper?
I think we're mildly non-monogamous. I think we do have some sexual adventures in us, and I actually think younger people are much less likely to be able to conduct monogamy. It depends, of course, how religiously observant you are, what kinds of moral code you have over you, and how well you you stick to it. But I think in general, it's not our natural instinct, but we have all other kinds of things to preserve. Our children, our parenting, our reputation, our love, our not having an undivided mind with our partner, not carrying lies. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into saying, you know what? Yeah, I'm attracted to that, but no, I'm not going to go there because I really know what I want to protect.
David, do you think that there's variation over time in people's willingness? Do cultural norms affect it in a substantial way, or do you think infidelity goes on at a fairly constant rate over time?
Yes. Well, of course, it varies from culture to culture. One of the things that I talk about in my book, The Evolution of Desire, mm-hmm. is the fact that polygyny, meaning men legally permitted to take multiple wives, has occurred in the majority of cultures over time. And so if you go to traditional cultures, it's very, very common. And so high-status men historically, that is over recorded history and over deep time, have been able to attract multiple females. And so in some ways we live in a weird modern environment where we have what's called socially imposed monogamy. I think long-term monogamous mating is part of our menu of mating strategies, but it's only one part.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the way of the affair, the circumstances and psychology of infidelity. It is as old as the hills and in the news again right now. Pepper Schwartz is here from the University of Washington in Seattle. David Buss from the University of Texas, Austin, author of The Dangerous Passion and the Evolution of Desire. Of course, we saw all kinds of denials and flameouts and emotion in high places. 1998, here was President Clinton firmly denying any sexual relationship ever occurred with Monica Lewinsky.
I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people.
I did not have maybe the most famous declarative sentence in recent American history, and he's back in the public eye and much lauded there lately. Not everybody fares so well. On the campaign trail in October 2007, reports broke of John Edwards' reputed infidelity. He firmly denied those reports.
The story's false. It's completely untrue and ridiculous. I've been in love with the same woman for 30-plus years as anybody who's been around us knows. She's an extraordinary human being. Warm, loving, beautiful, sexy, and as good a person as I have ever known. So the story's just false.
Except that it wasn't. On Sunday, on CBS's Face the Nation, commentator David Gergen said the scandal with David Petraeus marks a sad moment for the American people, but that he hopes Americans would be more understanding.
I would hope people would remember there have been other great leaders in this country. Remember President Eisenhower when he was General Eisenhower and Kay Summersby and how important that relationship was to him. Remember Franklin Roosevelt and Lucy Mercer, how important that relationship was to him in the Second World War. There, you know, I think we have to be understanding that, as the saying goes, the best of men are still men at their best.
David Gergen with a more sympathetic eye and ear on the story that's in the news right now. Lots of callers. Bill in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Bill, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
I'm concerned because I really feel like people are dancing around one issue that I don't think is palatable for a lot of us, but that's the fact that with our traditional American diet, with stress and with childbearing, that oftentimes the ladies of these relatively powerful male figures, their wives have not been or are not holding up to what we'd consider the current standards of being attractive. And so, of course, an individual like this who is in a powerful position does have the opportunity to find someone who is basically going to worship him, as it appears that Ms. Broadwell may very well have. And I think there's a better opportunity for him to go out and have an affair. You know, it's very difficult to stay in shape and be attractive after 30 years of marriage. And I think we can't discount that. I think it's something very base as opposed to a lot of these more complex psychological profiles of leadership that we're talking about.
Yeah, okay, base or basic, but that's also where, isn't it, where compassion and love would like to come in. I mean, Pepper, you look at, I don't know that much about Paula Broadwell's husband. I've seen photographs now. So what you see, Holly Petraeus, we've seen her a lot because of her prominence as the wife of such a prominent general, because of all of her work with veterans. You look at the pain that she is sort of obviously and reportedly in now, and my gosh, if that doesn't bring out compassion and or anger, what would?
Well, I think it does. I mean, I think we all talk about loyalty, and then so what's your reward for loyalty, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's been particularly unkind that some people say she's not beautiful. Well, she's a middle-aged woman, and she looks perfectly nice to me. You know, I think about your caller's idea that maybe some men go because their wives gain weight. Well, you know, Newt Gingrich is no looker, and he was seemingly, you know, he had a loyal wife who was sick, and there he goes having an affair with someone else. I mean, there is some sense of, yes, there's the desire. But in what sense do we owe anyone some protection from this kind of exposure and pain? I know that I'm writing a book with a couple of co-authors that's coming out in February. It's called The Normal Bar. And in that, we have a huge number of people, three-fourths of the guys, two-thirds of the women, say they would have an affair if there were absolutely no consequences. But when you say, you know, what if there were consequences, the number really drops because I think people do have compassion. They do understand loyalty. And I think most of them are loath to exact that pain on a partner. Grand passion allows them to bypass that sense of moral obligation. But it is there, even if some people push it away because they want what they want.
I mean, so interesting. Our listeners with an ear, some toward the moral obligation, some the human pain, others just drives. And Kristen says, I don't think that, you know, talking about one of our callers realizes it works both ways. She's talking about a man who called in. Women have drives and needs too. Brad tweets. He says, oh, come on. Sex with a four-star general beats sex with a radiologist. Radiologists of the world unite. Stand up for yourselves. Joan in New Haven, Connecticut. Hi, Joan. You're on the air.
Hi. I was involved with someone for 15 years who was definitely a narcissist and definitely exhibited signs of a borderline personality disorder. And I believe you cannot separate the psychological aspects from the affairs that happen. There's the rate of the number of people in the United States who have some sort of psychological disorder are so high. I can't believe that it doesn't play into the aspect of affairs. This person I was with for 15 years, I was very devoted to, very loyal. I supported this person through school and through all sorts of life crises. And when I sent the person off to school in another state, I received a phone call in May saying that we're through and can we remain friends? I said, sure, fine. I was crushed.
Sure.
And we remained friends, and it seemed like we were pretty much on track to getting back together again when something in my gut said something is wrong. So I repeatedly asked, is there something wrong? You feel like you're detaching from me. I feel like there's something you're holding back on. You have feelings for someone else. Is there someone else? Every time the answer was no. Until I finally caught the person, quote-unquote, red-handed, when they confessed everything, said she had absolutely no remorse for what she did. She needed to prove to herself that she could move on. And this person is a PhD candidate who teaches ethics, who's going to be teaching future generations of college students, who is obsessed with technology, but on the surface, it seems very competent, very sane, very stable. And this person actually lives her life within the realm of technology and not in the real world. And here I am alone after 15 years of loyalty.
And she's headed out to teach ethics, Joan. Oh my. We hear the pain in that story. And I mean, this is where it hits home. Joan, thank you for that. I mean, here, Pepper, the one in the dark who suspects, who comes out of this thinking there is a personality profile that's more prone, and who's facing an ethics teacher who says, well, that's the way it goes. Deal with it.
Well, I think it's true. I mean, I think we both, David and I, agree that someone who's narcissistic is much more likely to think only of what they need and not of what anyone else. We don't want to leave the person who's left, the person who's exposed, the person who's betrayed out of this picture. It's very painful. And there's a lifelong vulnerability to this, you know? I mean, I think one of the things we haven't said is that Petraeus is 60. He could have been 70. He could have been 80. While the rate of monogamy goes down, it is never extinguished. People's hearts and bodies stay alive. And if been neglected at home, then or they've shut off to their partner who has tried to reach out to them, either way, there's no age limit.
Wow.
Yeah. I would, David, just expand on that. And I think that the point about empathy for the victims in all this is an excellent one. And there are victims. I mean, infidelity does wreak havoc on marriages and destroys entire families. But I also think we have to have some empathy for those who live what's classically called lives of quiet desperation. There are people who have these desires and live their whole lives and have those desires unmet. And so I think the empathy has to be broadened.
And sometimes it just doesn't get that wide. I mean, sometimes people who don't expect themselves to, in that circumstance, find themselves there. Here's a listener who writes, I never expected, intended, or dreamed of ever being involved with someone who was married. But last year, after months of being courted, I wondered, why am I the marriage police? Once I allowed him to cross my boundary line, all bets were off. It's been a year-long roller coaster. I discovered aspects of myself, she writes, of which I'm not proud, especially that I'm capable of participating in deception. I've also realized that many, many people are involved in romantic relationships outside of marriage. I wonder, Pepper, if there's a kind of X-ray vision that comes once you've walked the path. Do people then see it more?
Yes, they do. I mean, they... anybody who's studied affairs, been in an affair, watched an affair, could look at the general and his lady and say, that's not just a relationship between the biographer and the biography. That is something else. You get a different antenna if you've been there on either side of it.
Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts, calling. Thanks, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm 56 years old. I've been married for 29 years. In my young adulthood, in the early 20s, late teens, I guess today you would call me a dog.
What do you mean?
If you had asked me at the age of 20 who I knew was most likely to have an extramarital affair someday, I would have said it would be me. It didn't make any sense to me that people were married for 30, 40, 50 years with one spouse. It made no sense. I ridiculed people who thought about things like fidelity. I've been married for 29 years. I've never had an affair. I've never wanted to have an affair. I could have had affairs, but the thing that kept me from having an affair wasn't anything noble on my part. It was simply the idea. One of your guests alluded to the idea that what they don't know won't hurt them, and that's why a lot of people justify these kinds of things. But my rationale has always been, what I know will hurt me.
What do you mean?
I mean, I could have an affair. I could have had affairs. I've worked around lots of women in the last 30 years, and I chose not to pursue such a thing, even though when I was 20, I knew damn well that was what I was going to do.
Because it would hurt you or because it would hurt your partner? Why?
The knowledge that I could do something that would hurt my wife so terribly if she knew about it is something that I could not live with. Even if I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that she would never find out, I would know that I was capable of doing that kind of thing. And I could not get up the next day and look at her. I could not try to carry on a normal life knowing that I did something that would have been so hurtful to her. It surprised me. Believe me, I'm surprised. I find myself at this age, and I think to myself, "How the hell did I do that?" I mean,
but yet you did. You had that restraint, and it was something inside you that said, "No, I don't want to hurt someone in that way." David, how about that? Are we talking about an outlier here? Is that the majority of people in relationships who find a break in exactly that sentiment or not?
Well, I think people put the brakes on for a variety of reasons, and the caller mentions internal guilt, which is, mm-hmm. I think, which is one. He would have the knowledge that he has transgressed and violated the sanctity of their marriage. Some people are deterred by reputational damage, some by their moral or religious views, and the fact is that people do suffer reputational damage. So Petraeus is suffering it. Clinton suffered. He was able to repair his damaged reputation to a large degree, but some never do recover. So I think there are a variety of deterrents, and that's the fascinating question, Tom, is that people have these desires for people other than their marriage partner, and some act on it, and some choose not to.
So, Pepper, give us your advice here. Our time begins to grow short for those who are, let's say, in relationships and hope that this doesn't happen to them. First, what's your advice for those who have, strayed and hope to fix it up? What's your advice, Pepper?
Well, for those people who don't want an affair to happen, I mean, obviously, if you're with an absolute narcissist, there's not much you can do. But in most relationships, just never put it on automatic pilot. Be sexually, emotionally engaged. Have dates, however hackneyed that sounds. Be lovers. Do not turn into parents or just an efficient work unit. Make sure that romance and that connection and that intimacy never goes away. It's the best insurance I can think of. And as far as making up afterwards, I think a lot of people really have to go and get a third person involved, therapy, to find out why it happened, to learn how to give forgiveness, to find out what was the key that opened that door that needs to be shut and to be believed in, to create a new relationship based on trust and more knowledge, more intimacy. I have seen a lot of relationships who have gone through an affair and come out stronger and better because they now know how to love each other better. So I wouldn't say it's
what's
the
recovery rate you've seen, Pepper? What percentage of relationships survive that when it becomes known?
I'd say at least half. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people say they wouldn't leave, but when it comes to really seeing what they would lose, they don't go.
David?
The statistics that I'm familiar with show that about two-thirds of the cases, the infidelity ends up destroying the marriage. So about one-third are able to survive it in one way or another. But I think that it's extremely difficult to survive. If you look in cross-cultural perspective, infidelity is the single largest cause of divorce. It's extremely difficult to regain that trust once it's lost. And so it's not just the sexual violation, it's the violation of trust, and it's the emotional infidelity aspect that also is a real killer for relationships.
Pepper, you look at Holly and David Petraeus, long relationship, him gone a lot, but you know, it goes way back to the college West Point days. Do you see hope there?
I do. If I had to make a money bet, I would bet they stay together. They have 34 years, children, grandchildren, a life together. I think they could repair this.
Well, now the whole country will watch at least the exterior of that, a story that's been repeated millions and millions and millions of times, I guess, over the years. And once again, right there in front of us. I'm really grateful to the two of you for helping us just sit and think about this a little again today. It's one of those old stories that always comes back new, sometimes painfully. Pepper Schwartz at the University of Washington, Seattle, author of Prime, Adventures and Advice on Sex, Love, and the Sensual Years. Pepper, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. I very much enjoyed it.
And David Buss, author of The Dangerous Passion, with us from Austin, Texas. Thank you, David, for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Good luck. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.